Competition is the name of the game for all television networks. They compete with each other for a chunk of the TV audience and for the kind of programming that they think will help attract and keep that audience. At the start, cable appeared to help PBS in the quest for a larger audience, picking up local stations and spreading them to a much larger viewing area. But what cable gives, it can also take away. And as more stations have sprung up to compete for a slot on the cable dial, the smaller stations are being dropped from the cable lineup. Often these are PBS stations from outside the major viewing area. Nearly as devastating is when a cable system pushes PBS to the higher numbered channels on the dial. Don Yupa, vice president of the PBS station KCET-TV in Los Angeles, says several cable systems pushed his station into the 20s from such easy-to-tune-in stations as 3 and 6. He organized a strong and effective viewer protest to bring it back down.
If you go above channel 13, you lose about 50% of your viewing audience. Most people are still very, very much programmed to go through 2 to 13, even with some of these sophisticated monitor equipment that we have today, people still watch between 2 and 13.
If the FCC is no longer allowed to protect local PBS stations on the cable dial, the kind of bumping that KCET is fighting may become even more common. Although James Mooney, president of the National Cable Television Association, says cable systems nearly always give viewers at least one PBS station.
How many public broadcasting stations is enough? Especially when, you know, there are other things that people would like to see. C-SPAN, Arts and Entertainment, Nickelodeon, which is a children's channel, Discovery, which is primarily documentaries. We have to be careful that those programming services don't get squeezed out.
Not only is PBS competing for dial space, it's also finding competition for the specialized audience it has always claimed for itself, the small but loyal following for what PBS likes to call quality programming, a mix of public affairs, science documentaries, and arts presentations. PBS was virtually the only place an audience could find these shows until the recent onslaught of cable networks. On a cable system, viewers might now find Bravo, devoted to the fine arts, the Discovery Channel with its scientific bent, or A&E, the Arts and Entertainment Network, which programs drama, comedy, performing arts, and documentaries.
March, 1861. Jefferson Davis has been sworn in as provisional president of the Confederacy.
The Divided Union, a five-part A&E series on the Civil War, aired last fall. A&E president Nicholas Devatsis speculates that the popularity of that series is part of the reason PBS is now putting together its own Civil War series. But Devatsis isn't crowing about beating PBS on this topic. He argues that his network is actually helping PBS when it offers competitive programming.
The audience that we attract is really quite similar, and we, along with a number of other cable services like C-SPAN, Nickelodeon, and Discovery Channel, have doubled in the last 4 years the viewers who watch that kind of programming. My perspective is that we're all good for each other. We are growing the audience for quality programming together.
As Devatsis is quick to add, he's not in the business to promote PBS. They are competing for that larger audience. And Chicago Tribune TV critic Steve Daly points out the competition isn't limited to fine arts stations. Last fall, Daly was surprised to see the mainstream HBO network giving a full hour to the quirky comedy monologues of Spalding Gray, known for his film Swimming to Cambodia. Gray was first seen on national TV via PBS, but Daly and other TV viewers saw his next special on cable.
When it rolled up on the HBO schedule, I was stunned, and it turned out to be a pretty good piece of television. It was called The Terrors of Pleasure. I don't know if anybody watched it. I did, and spent the whole hour sitting there thinking, this is a PBS program. This is the sort of thing they ought to be doing, as opposed to, you know, the tributes to Perry Como. There's an element of risk-taking in it, which I think is something that people had in mind when they started public broadcasting in the first place.
Sometimes there's a show that's so perfect for both PBS and a cable network that they'll join forces, co-producing the piece to make their dollars stretch for a top-quality production.
Bring order to the whole through design.
The drama Sunday in the Park with George was a co-production of PBS and the Showtime Network.
Composition. Balance.
Sunday in the Park aired first on Showtime, then later on PBS. Neither network could afford to produce it alone, and the audiences of both were winners in this quest for quality. But KCET's Don Yupa says the audience will lose if that type of collaboration between cable and public television becomes the rule instead of the exception.
I think we've got to find ways to fund our own programs. I still think there are opportunities for us, and we've just got to find the ways to fund them. My own personal opinion is public television ought to stay public television and do our own thing and do it as well as we've always done it over the years and continue to seek the independent funding as opposed to move into more cooperative efforts.
And so KCET is focusing on specialized local shows that no network, public or commercial, would offer, like this recent documentary on Latino immigration in Southern California.
Though Latinos have always been here, in the last 20 years, their number has more than doubled. Most of the newcomers are working class. And as other groups of immigrants did before them, they have aroused hostility and resentment.
With its use of still photos and a single reporter, this is not a slick network production. You wouldn't find it on HBO, Showtime, or even PBS's Frontline. But it does address a local concern, and that's what critic Steve Daly thinks local PBS stations should be doing. He thinks many public TV powerhouses, including Chicago's WTTW, rely too heavily on safe offerings from the network. He's hoping competition from cable will spark more stations to get busy on shows of their own.
I think that there's an institutional tendency in public broadcasting to think that because that it is viewer-supported television, that we all have to somehow root for them, that they get a pass on everything, that they shouldn't be criticized, all their shows should be praised. There's this aura of nobility that I don't think is very healthy that sprung up around public television. And to the extent that cable television knocks the corners off some of that, they might be doing public television a favor.
And perhaps doing the television audience a favor by sparking better programming on both PBS and cable as the networks compete to produce that elusive entity they all call quality programming. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. They call themselves an actor's theater, dedicated to their own craft as opposed to a certain director or playwright. They've created their own style and almost brutal realism.
I'll tell you what. I'll give you a last chance, see if you can come up with something, but no cliches or whinings or bang!
Look, please, please.
It's a whine, Whittacombe.
I've got a wife and two kids.
That's a cliche and a whine. Can't waste any further time giving you chances. If you can't take the center, even at a moment like this, you can't. One?
No, no, no.
Two?
No, 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 no.
Three?
Oh, God!
That, a scene from Steppenwolf's production of the murder mystery Stage Struck, is the kind of gripping performance Steppenwolf is known for. From such groundbreaking works as the rock and roll-based Balm and Gilead to Sam Shepard's True West, which skyrocketed Steppenwolf to fame through a New York production that was also broadcast on PBS. John Mahoney, heard as the gunman in that scene, says it's known as the Chicago style.
If we did Sound of Music, probably they'd all be cut and slashed to death or something. You know, we've got this reputation for blood and guts and pain and rock and roll and actors slamming off walls and everything like that. But that's only a ferocity of intent that we have in our acting. And we have that same ferocity and that same intensity in language-oriented plays. If I'm on stage, I'd much rather listen to an actor say, yeah, it's a nice day today. Which is the Chicago style, as opposed to what I've observed in New York, which is, it's a nice day. You know, it just gets so boring to listen to all that.
It's a logical style for a company that started as a group of friends and is now just a bigger group of friends, an ensemble of 21 company members whose individual talents shine brightest when combined. It's a loosely knit ensemble, though, now that Mahoney, John Malkovich, Glenn Headley, and so many other company members are finding fame in New York and Hollywood. Mahoney, for instance, is drawing rave reviews as a frequently unlucky dinner date in the movie Moonstruck. He also had parts in Suspect, Tin Men, and The Manhattan Project. But like any other Steppenwolf member who makes it big, Mahoney comes home from time to time to rejoin his friends.
I don't mind taking huge risks here because I'm with friends and I know that they'll, you know, I'm not going to look stupid. Whereas if I'm doing a play down the street or a play in New York, I want to, you know, I want to be a little bit cool, and I want to be, I want people to, you know, not think I'm an idiot. But I don't care if they think I'm an idiot here. In fact, I know they don't think I'm an idiot. They know that I'm just trying different things.
Have a cigar.
Thanks. I'll give it to a congressman.
$5 a piece it cost me from Cuba someplace.
Well, in that case, I'll give it to a senator.
Senator's pretty big stuff around here, huh?
Yes.
Jeez.
Why? Shouldn't they be?
Listen, you know what's a senator to me? Guy makes about $200 a week.
They seem to finish each other's sentences. They have a unique chemistry. They can expect a reaction on stage, and all of this results in a very molded kind of nurturing kind of performance.
Chicago Sun-Times theater critic Glenna Seiss says that at the company's own theater, the realism is underscored by the placement of the stage itself. It juts into the audience of just 211 seats. Usually, all the seats are full. The small house was always part of Steppenwolf's plan, and it's part of what drew company member Glenn Headley, who first saw Steppenwolf during a performance of The Caretaker.
It was so intimate and so real that kind of scared me. And I thought, now see, this is what I would really like to do in theater, where you can just look at someone sideways and the audience can see that and know just what that means. Whereas when you're in a big house, you know, it doesn't happen.
And yet Steppenwolf is preparing to move to a larger theater, hoping to accommodate at least a few more of their nearly 10,000 subscribers. They may lose some of their intimacy on the main stage, but a second, smaller stage will give the company a chance for their experimental works, the kind that will keep the Steppenwolf tradition alive. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
Trying to make that dough. Rolling on the toba, rolling on the toba, doing a vaudeville show.
Going in the back door, can't take it no more.
Abuse.
Confused.
Misfused.
Accused. Jim Crow, segregated, barred out, eliminated. Man, why are we here? Because we're rolling, rolling, trying to make that dough.
Roland was a way of life for vaudevillians on the 1920s Theater Owners Booking Association tour, the Toba Circuit, which included theaters around the country catering to primarily black audiences. Many black actors couldn't find work on the white circuits. Others preferred the Toba crowd, despite the rough life for traveling performers.
You had to travel a lot. You, as a performer, you really couldn't get used to anything because things were constantly changing. And we speak about what it's like to be hungry and not even and being black performers and not even being able to go into a restaurant and get something to eat. Yet our names are up on lights. We got a pocket full of money. The audiences are loving us, but we can't even go get a meal.
Yeah, another nickname called Tough on Black Actors or Tough on Black Asses, right? Mm-hmm. That was another...
That's what we called it.
Right.
In this revival show called Roland with Stevens and Stewart, it's modern-day actors Ronald Smokey Stevens and Jay Stewart who are traveling the circuit. But their material is gleaned from records of those who did the toba in the 1920s. Burt Williams, Pigmeat Markham, the Whitman Sisters, Moms Mabley, and Bill Bojangles Robinson.
Why, it's the Bill Robinson walk. The latest way of going to town, it's the Bill Robinson walk. You can pick 'em up and lay 'em down. Why, it's a treat for dancing feet, folks. Don't hesitate.
Life on the vaudevillian Toba circuit was hard, but then it was hard for blacks just about everywhere in the country during those years. Stevens and Stewart capture the flavor of that life by weaving together comedy bits and literature from and about those days. Often it's hard to tell where the comedy stops and the serious messages begin, as in this version of the Langston Hughes saga of Just Be Simple.
I done might not spent my last nickel for this here paper, and don't you know there ain't no news in it about no colored folks nowhere? Take flying saucers for an example. Now, here it says in this paper that everybody has seen a flying saucer flying in the sky.
Yeah.
Everybody but a Negro. They probably won't even let flying saucers fly over the south side of Chicago just to keep us from seeing one.
Yeah.
Now, look at here. Here it says a Carl Grubelowski. He didn't see one.
Mm-hmm.
And a Giottani Bottini. He didn't see one. But you ever hear about a Willie Jones?
Or Ralph Johnson.
Or a Johnny Two Sweet Leach.
Or Gator Mouth Jones.
Or Razorhead Smith.
Or Booty Magruder.
Or anybody.
They're short stories, and we've edited them into monologues and scenes.
And conversational dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
When was that written? In the 40s?
No, that was like 50s, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
UFOs weren't as big in the 20s and 30s as in the 50s. But you felt it still.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's something to talk about as we riding along on the Topasig.
The material Stevens and Stewart did take directly from the Toba circuit was clearly written to be performed by blacks for blacks. These theaters gave talented performers a rare opportunity to take the stage without degrading blackface. Their routines were honest reflections of their lives, as opposed to the material Stevens uncovered from blacks who performed in the white theaters.
There was a song that Mamie Smith recorded called Lure of the South, where you have Mamie Smith, one of the first black blues singers, idolizing being down in the South on the plantation and working in the cotton fields all day long, singing and a dancing and a making songs. Oh, what a happy time. Now, I mean, come on. Right? So that would be some of the kind of material that would be performed in a white environment. And in a black environment, they'd probably be singing a blues song. When life seems full of clouds and rain, and I am filled with naught but pain, who soothes my bumping, thumping brain? Nobody. Oh, 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 I...
Not only did Stevens and Stewart find the Toba material more realistic, Stevens says the humor is timeless.
This material is tested and tried. It has weathered the years. It is as funny today as it was when they were performing it. And it's cleaner because they didn't use all them curse words back then.
Right.
It's just good,
right.
Clean fun.
But this revival show isn't just for laughs. Jay Stewart says he has a more important reason for going on tour with this material.
It's just like the jazz. There's an article in Ebony, like, are blacks giving jazz away? You know, the literature that I had, you know, is like going off into obscurity. This comedy material, you know, is fading off. And this stuff has to stay alive. There's a message about triumph over adversity. You know, we call the show Rolling. And those people, once that circuit ended, they couldn't stop. You know, and like some of them made it right on up, like I say to Ed Sullivan and things like this. And it's like, you know, once you decide to make your living as an entertainer, you know, you have to just keep rolling with the kind of things you come across.
Oh, gee, it's so nice to have a gal so big and fat that when you hug and kiss her, you don't know where you at. You have to take some chalk in your hand and hug away and chalk away to see where you began. One day, I was a hugging and a chalking and begging her to be my bride. When I saw another fella with some chalk in his hand coming around the other side, it was my cousin coming around the other side.
Roland with Stevens and Stewart opened in Chicago, where the Toba circuit began. But these actors aren't so dedicated to realism that they'll follow the rest of the old circuit, which was mostly in the South. Stevens and Stewart did a few shows in Houston and are now headed for Detroit, Toronto, and Los Angeles. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Host intro. It takes more than formal schooling or even an informal study of the classics to make a great artist. The art world has given a special title to those without that background, calling them outside artists or naive artists. But that's not to say that they have a lesser talent than those with a more formal perspective. Marge Halperin reports now on one of the foremost outsiders, black folk artist Bill Traylor, who produced some 1,500 drawings in a 3-year creative spurt that started when he was 84 years old. This tour is sponsored by the Chicago Council on Fine Arts. In 3, 2, 1. Bill Traylor was born a slave, staying after emancipation to work on his master's farm near Benton, Alabama. While he farmed, Traylor literally never put a pencil to paper, to write or to draw. It was only after he'd outlived his usefulness in the country and moved to Montgomery that he began drawing to make a bit of pocket change in the city. Traylor sketched the farm scenes from his memory and the street scenes where he worked, selling his drawings for a quarter. Today, they're worth several $1,000s each, and Chicago collector Joe Wilkinson owns dozens of them.
To me, the work is very emotional. The drawings really come to life. I mean, the actual characters that he's painted, I find just powerful. They just seem to capture what he went through.
At first glance, Traylor's drawings appear almost childlike. Their human characters are just darkened silhouettes. But Traylor makes these simple figures jump off the page with such subtle touches as a gleaming eye, an upturned mouth, or gesturing hands. And he drops them into lively scenes, as in Red House with Figures, among Wilkinson's favorites.
On the back of this one was written, "Old lady fussed at him so much he came out in the yard to read. And she came out after him. The little girl listened to what she tell him." That's what we see in the picture. But boy, you see a lot more. You see some animals going up a ladder, one guy chasing the other guy. This guy's beating this guy, caught him doing something, and obviously about to flog him. Here's the lady coming out after the man who's reading. You've got somebody drinking, and it looks like this person's doing a somersault.
The written description of that picture, and just about everything else we know about Traylor's work, comes from his friend and mentor, artist Charles Shannon. Shannon discovered the 84-year-old Traylor on a Montgomery street in 1939, as he was just beginning to draw. Shannon didn't want to speak on the air, but he did tell us that Traylor liked to keep his work simple. Shannon brought him slick artist paper and colors, but Traylor ignored them, choosing instead to draw on ripped-up cardboard boxes, using pencil, charcoal, and only an occasional spot of bright tempera colors. Those simple materials were all Traylor needed to create what Art in America correspondent Michael Bonesteel says are very complex drawings.
To me, Bill Traylor's work is very modern, coming from his imagination more than his observation. You really have the feeling that this particular, say, drinking bout or this particular hunting incident didn't happen the way that we see it. He's elaborated on it, and he's added things and really made it into his own composition, much in the way that any modernist artist would. I think this is very sophisticated for a self-taught artist. I think you could stand this next to a Paul Klee or a Joan Miró, and I think it would stand up really quite nicely.
Bonesteel is especially impressed by Traylor's animals, which he drew more often than human subjects.
I think that's one of the most wonderful rabbits I've ever seen. There's a very lifelike quality to that rabbit. Its eye is sort of looking to off in one direction, kind of alert. One ear is kind of sticking up more than the other, as if it's scoping the area. I think it's a very well-observed rabbit, although I doubt if the rabbit was standing in front of him when he did it. He's probably seen so many rabbits that he was able to simply, you know, do this right off the top of his head.
Charles Shannon watched those vivid drawings take shape from what were Traylor's first experiments on paper, simple lines drawn with a straight edge. It's likely Traylor's creative spirit grew only because of Shannon's encouragement. Traylor's artistic life ended when Shannon was drafted in 1942. Traylor died 5 years later, never having made another drawing of value. But Shannon's support did not die, and in 1979, he launched Traylor as a national art figure by organizing a one-man show. Traylor's work is back on the road this month, on display at Chicago's Cultural Center, as the first stop of a tour that will include Boston, Los Angeles, Louisville, Raleigh, and Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It is 3 years of drawings that span a lifetime of experience. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
I see you have a Let There Be Lights button. Do you live around Wrigley Field?
No, suburbs.
And why do you want lights?
Why do I want lights? Oh, I like to see night ball. Just something new for the Cubs. Be nice to come out first game. I usually just get to the weekend games because they're working during the week, so be kind of nice.
I don't think it's going to work. I hope they all stay days games only.
You don't think it'll work? In what sense?
There's no room around here for people at night. You know, if you live in the neighborhood, you don't have anywhere to park at night as it is without all the extra people here.
Do you live in the neighborhood?
I don't live too far away, but I know the problem, and I sympathize with the people.
Okay, but would you go at night?
Probably just to one to see how it is, you know, but I think that's about how it's going to be with a lot of people. Once they find out all the headaches that are involved with no parking in the area, they're not going to come back.
I don't think the people in the neighborhood, they don't want the games, and it's their neighborhood, and they shouldn't have them if they don't want them. They should respect the people in the neighborhood. It's their community.
It's just a tradition, you know. Baseball's kind of a traditional sport. You hold on to those kinds of things. And now it's going to go, you know, because you can make more money with night games, and you just don't like the idea at all.
Well, I like baseball because it's supposed to be played in the daytime. And being an old-timer, I like daylight baseball. That is the game, not nightfall.
Will you go to night games?
No, definitely not.
Well, I'm for them.
Why?
Because I think it gives everybody an opportunity to go and see the games that are working, like me, downtown during the day.
So you wouldn't otherwise get to see the Cubs as often?
Not as often. Mm-hmm. And I've been a Cub fan for many, many years. But I do feel for the people in the neighborhood. They have their points, too. I feel sorry for them.
I'm real excited about it.
Just an exciting event to see the Cubs play under the lights in Wrigley Field. It's a beautiful ballpark and makes it nice.
It's long overdue.
Why? What's the advantage?
Because all of us aren't unemployed and we can't get here during the day. I don't think 8 night games will destroy the neighborhood either. If 8 night games would destroy the neighborhood, it's not worth saving.
Would you go?
Yes, I guess so. But I live in the neighborhood, so I'm afraid of what might happen. Just so much traffic and people and noise.
I think the congestion is there no matter when. It's just a matter if it's during the daytime or the nighttime. It's nice to have a place to park, though, when you do come home from work. And I do have that problem occasionally.
I've been coming out here for 20 years, and I'm just, day games is what Cub baseball is all about.
I think all the other stadiums in the country should ban lights. It's a great tradition. It's too bad it's going
to
die.
I used to live here about maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and the only problem I could see was parking. But if they can control the parking, you know, find spaces, I think it'll be all right.
It's not going to be any less crowded than usual. I mean, you can't park here anyway, so there's no problem as far as I'm concerned.
They need them. It's, you know, it's more fun. And
want to keep the Cubbies.
Yeah, we got to keep them here. And I don't think the neighborhood's going to be any worse than it is now.